From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
When a draft recommendation from UNESCO's World Heritage Committee this week said that the Great Barrier Reef should be added to a list of World Heritage sites that are in danger, the federal government responded by saying the recommendation was politically inspired and a complete surprise. It also suggested, behind the scenes, that China's hand was involved. Yet the risks to the reef have been obvious for many years. For example, in 2015, UNESCO had identified climate change, poor water quality, and the impact of coastal development as major threats to the health of the reef. Environment Minister Susan Lee has labelled UNESCO's recommendation as a backflip, claiming that the Australian government had been assured that no such proposal was about to be made. Faced with the recommendation, the government is now mounting a strong campaign to try to head off this being turned into a firm decision when the World Heritage Committee, which is chaired by China, meets in July. To discuss the reef and the government's response to the recommendation, we're joined by Susan Lee and also by her opposition shadow, Terry Butler. Susan Lee, how have we got to this point? It's been known for years that the reef was in danger, and Australia was put on notice as far back as 2015. Over the past 5 years, a series of reports has warned that the reef is deteriorating, including a 2019 report by the government's own Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, which said the reef's condition had declined from poor to very poor. So how can this proposed listing have come as a surprise to you?
The World Heritage Committee raised concerns about the Great Barrier Reef as early as 2011-12. And when we came into government in 2013, our Environment Minister, Greg Hunt, engaged very closely with UNESCO. And our approach as a country then was, let's work with you. We understand your concern about the future of this vast and spectacular ecosystem. Let's work with you. Actually, that's still my call to UNESCO today. And from that point, the Reef 2050 plan came about. Huge investment in water quality, which is one of the critical ingredients, if you like, of a healthy reef, have been made. And they've been adjusted and they've been increased. And there's been a conversation with UNESCO via its World Heritage Committee along the way. So they have seen the work that we've done leading back to that original decision. Now, what the decision that we saw released the other night has done is actually jump several logical stages of engagement to straight to a recommendation for endangered listing. It is almost unheard of within the World Heritage Committee system to actually do that. And when I saw that, my surprise about the complete perversion of this process was followed quickly by, okay, if UNESCO, via its technical committees, wants to make a statement about climate change more broadly, I would assume that the 82 properties that are also judged to be high or very high climate risk would be put on the in danger list at the same time, or at least headed in that direction. So let's see the job lot to make the strong point, or let's have the usual approach that works with countries. Instead, we've seen one property, our property, and my view from conversations I've had over the weekend is that the World Heritage Committee actually does recognise, in fact, their report endorses the investment we've made and the work that we've done, actually acknowledges all that. But they do want to make a statement about global climate change. And they also want to make that statement to other countries, not to us. So I hope that gives Michelle some sense of why we do feel blindsided by the process of the Great Barrier Reef, an area we just care deeply about.
We'll come back to the politics, but first, why is the government so determined not to have the reef listed as in danger when it's obviously struggling despite the work done? And is it simply to preserve the government's, Australia's reputation abroad? Is it because it would be a risk to tourism? Wouldn't it be better to acknowledge the problems the reef has and get the help of the international community that
it
needs?
What normally follow an in danger listing is recommendations from the World Heritage Committee about doing all the things that a country, a state party, is not doing and should do. But we are doing our best, and arguably from the draft decision itself, while there are some comments about water quality, what we are doing so far has been really strongly acknowledged. So what this listing does is send completely the wrong message about the environment more broadly, but also the wrong message about the for our Australian catchments, communities, fishers, marine biologists, scientists who live and work along the reef. I absolutely understand that climate change is the single biggest threat to our reef. It is under pressure from that. But what this UNESCO convention is all about is, having accepted that, how do you help your site to adapt? How do you bring the best possible science, the best possible field management, the best possible water quality actions, including regulations in the state of Queensland? All of that is happening. So an in danger listing is actually sending completely the wrong message. And more importantly, what it's saying to the other 20 odd reefs that are also on World Heritage sites, what help do you have if the system is going to single out Australia? Because I can tell you, Michelle, those other countries know that we are the gold standard of management for tropical reefs, and they look to us. In fact, we are recognised internationally for that science and for that deep understanding and for the leading edge of adaptation when it comes, for example, to heat-resistant corals. So I would argue that this decision is actually contrary to the interests of reefs across the world and every site that is exposed to climate change. I should add too that at the next meeting, the committee is due to consider a whole climate protocol, which Australia was quite active in contributing to. So we were at the front line of saying, let's look at the effect of climate change on World Heritage properties and let's do this well. We're not stepping back from that threat.
Now, you mentioned that the government feels blindsided by this recommendation, but a UNESCO official today is quoted as denying suggestions that the government was told a week ago it would not be recommending the listing. The official said to The Guardian, and I quote, "We don't share decisions before they're finalised." What's your reply to this?
Well, it wouldn't surprise listeners to know that there are conversations in diplomatic and ambassadorial circles that reflect realities that may not be made public at the time. I am absolutely confident that this was not insight, was not a course of action that was considered about to happen as much as a week or 10 days ago. So this was sudden, hence my description of being blindsided. And that's because I know that UNESCO and its advisory bodies rely heavily on process. It's a rules-based international order. We all understand that. This time the rules have not been followed. And one of those rules has been, and I talked about the long lead-up that would normally happen, a foreshadowing exercise, a foreshadowing statement about we're not sure about the reef, we're foreshadowing Australia, that we might like to put it on the in danger list. The response would then be from me, I understand your concern, have a reactive monitoring mission and look at the latest data. Because what has been relied on here is a 2019 Outlook report, and that is not the latest information. The Australian Institute of Marine Science releases an annual report, and it's actually indicated that the reef, the latest coral bleaching event, has seen strong recovery in the reef. We've also got updated information from 2019 data. So the desktop review approach, certainly not appreciated by Australia.
So are you saying that this remark a week or so ago about nothing happening would have been an informal remark rather than a formal one?
Well, clearly it's not formal, and even the draft recommendation is still only a draft recommendation. So that's why Maurice Payne and I had a late night hookup with the Director General of UNESCO on Monday night to say we've now seen the draft recommendation, or we've seen what we believe the draft recommendation will be, and we want very urgently to ask you to remove the immediate in danger list, and not to say we, UNESCO, have no concerns about the reef, but to go through the right process, which is to foreshadow the possibility of an endangered listing. Let's look at the latest data. Let's come out and see the reef for ourselves. Let's understand what you, Australia, are doing and have done since you put the Reef 2050 plan in place.
But this assurance that you and others have spoken about last week or a week ago, that was an informal thing rather than anything more, are you saying?
It was informal, but I am confident that that is exactly where the proposal was not. And then all of a sudden, a different proposal appears. So the assurances that were sought and received over a long period of time did not indicate that this immediate in danger listing would be recommended for the July meeting of the World Heritage Committee. And while, as I said, there's a lot of rules-based approach and for those who, you know, perhaps aren't as close to the United Nations and UNESCO systems, it all does all sound very procedural. My point is that that process matters. That process is one that we all understand. And the wrong process has produced the wrong outcome.
Now, there's been muttering within the government, and you have referred to this, that there's politics in this decision. And behind the scenes, people are claiming China had a hand. China chairs the Heritage Committee. What's the evidence for the politics?
There are international politics at play, clearly. Otherwise, we would not have this peremptory listing going from, as I describe it, the beginning of a conversation that reflects concern about the reef, from a perfectly understandable point of view, to a sudden in danger listing recommendation less than a month from a meeting. So clearly there are international
politics. So this is another strike by China against Australia? Is that how you see it?
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the international politics at play have subverted the normal and proper process. Now, others can make judgments about what those international politics are. It's not my role to do that. It's my role as Australia's Environment Minister to fight our cause, and I will be doing that with the 21 countries that make up the World Heritage Committee prior to the meeting that they're expected to have, probably the 20th of July, and make the points very strongly for those who may not know the work that we have done. So this has never been set and forget, and I want the other countries to understand, and I want them to see the risk to their own World Heritage sites. Climate change is the biggest threat to our reef, but it's also the biggest threat to every single reef and every single glacier and rainforest, arguably. So let's work out how we as a committee, Australia's stepping off the World Heritage Committee at this meeting, but that the committee more broadly deals with climate change on World Heritage properties. But coming back to climate policy, that is best dealt with in the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change, not in this convention, which is about managing your site well.
But coming back to the politics, you're not discouraging the naming of China, and certainly behind the scenes, the government's encouraging China being in the frame.
I'm not getting into that. That's not my responsibility as Australia's Environment Minister.
But if it is a political exercise, as you are saying, what chance do you have of changing this decision or preventing the recommendation becoming a final decision? How can you effectively lobby? Isn't this, on your argument that it's political, a fait accompli?
If the politicisation of a process that we have constructively contributed to for over 40 years is now going to be the norm, the points that I will make with the 21 member countries and others who might influence them is that this is the moment to reflect on what the World Heritage Committee is all about and consider the risk to your own properties. Because if the entire system is politicised, then we aren't going to be acting in the interests of the natural heritage values of these places. And obviously the World Heritage Convention is about the built environment, but I'm focusing on the natural environment at the moment with the reef. So this is about the structure and integrity and processes of a committee that we value, that I value, and that I want to see succeed.
Will the Prime Minister become directly involved in this lobbying campaign?
I'm not sure what the Prime Minister is doing after he leaves the security of quarantine.
Well, he does have a telephone.
Maurice Payne and I had a it was a frustrating but in many ways revealing conversation with UNESCO, and we will continue to work very closely together with our posts, and that's the front face of the engagement that we will have.
Why was it frustrating? Was it tense or just a stone wall you were dealing with?
It was frustrating because it became apparent that while UNESCO committees are aware of the $3 billion of investment in our reef, they also wanted to send a strong signal to the world about climate change. Now, I didn't necessarily hear a strong signal to Australia. I heard a strong signal to the world needing to do more. And we know that there are greater emitters of greenhouse gases than Australia. We also know, by the way, that Australia needs to play its part, and I'm very committed to doing that via technology, via adaptation. I mean, since 2015, when we signed up to Paris, we've spent $15 billion as a country on adaptation. We're teaching the world as we learn, as a country exposed to drought and heat waves, and of course, the reef is an example of that pressure. We're engaging with the rest of the world and teaching others, particularly in our region, how science can help adapt. But meanwhile, we know that the global challenge of climate change is not one that Australia's trajectory of emissions can really change in the near future.
Susan Lee, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure.
Terry Butler, do you agree with this proposed listing?
Well, I actually think it's really important that the Morrison government does everything that they possibly can to avoid the Great Barrier Reef being listed as in danger. But that also doesn't excuse them from the obligation to do everything that they can to protect and preserve the Great Barrier Reef and the 64,000 jobs that depend upon it, plus $6.4 billion in revenue in an ordinary year. It's really important that they demonstrate to the world that they're serious about protecting the reef, preserving it for future generations. And if they do that, they should also be in a position to fight really hard to avoid this particular listing.
What would be the negative if it is listed as in danger? Would that not produce more care of it and more awareness of its importance internationally?
I think if you spoke to tourism operators, particularly from Cairns and far north Queensland, but up and down the length of the reef, they would tell you that that public global concern, that the reef is already dead, that the reef is beyond saving, has caused a significant downturn in tourism, or concerns about a significant downturn in tourism at least. And of course, they've also had an annus horribilis with the coronavirus pandemic, and international travel having to close down. But even before coronavirus, they would tell you that the bleaching events and the global publicity about them cause people to effectively give up their plans to go to the reef, and also have a negative impact on conservation efforts too. Because if the broader public think it's too late, then the imperative to spend effort and time and money on conserving it is lessened, is weakened. And so tourism operators and environmentalists alike, I think, would be very alarmed at the prospect of losing public sentiment towards protecting the reef and towards visiting the reef. And that's why I'm saying the government really needs to do what it can to avoid the listing of the reef as being in danger. But that's not just a question of optics appearances, it's actually about demonstrating the genuine efforts to protect and preserve the reef, and there's a number of components of that.
But in terms of the environmental concerns, you could argue surely the other way, that if people were aware that it was in danger, they might be more anxious to pressure for action.
It's a finely balanced question, because if people think that there is a need to protect the reef, then that can be an encouragement for action. But if people think it's too late to protect the reef, then that can be a significant discouragement to action. And so the question, I think, for tourism and operators and environmentalists, and I don't mention those two groups as though they're somehow entirely separate, as though it's two separate circles on a Venn diagram. There is an overlap. A lot of the tourism operators are environmentalists themselves. They would be concerned about anything that would send the wrong message, that would say everyone give up on the reef. And people shouldn't give up on the reef. I visited the reef earlier this year myself with the head of the Australian Marine Park Tourism Operators, who's also himself an ecologist and met with people who were scientists working on the reef, it is very clear that the reef is a beautiful place to visit, that people should visit. I'm a bit biased. Cairns is my hometown. I grew up on the Great Barrier Reef. I love it. I think it's incredibly significant and beautiful. I think it's really important that there be this really strong encouragement to people to continue to visit, to see the beauty, to see the diversity in the ecosystems that are there. And so I think that tourism operators, environmentalists alike, would say it's so important not to give this doomsday impression of the reef. And the best way to encourage conservation efforts is to encourage people to visit. And as I say, that's about maintaining optimism and hope about the future of the reef, as well as clear-eyed understanding of the environmental threats.
When you were there, what were the experts and the locals generally, I guess, telling you about the state of things, how bad it is, or whether the problems are being exaggerated?
Look, they've had a tough year economically, there's no doubt about that. I visited in January 2021, so of course they'd had a significant amount of difficulty with international borders closing. So it's a tough time in Cairns at the moment. As to the reef itself, it's really important to those operators that I spoke to that they are showcasing what the reef has to offer, and it's also important to them that tourists that visit the reef are getting a science-informed perspective about the threats to the reef and about the possibilities for conservation. I didn't meet anyone when I was up there who denied that climate change was the greatest threat to the reef, and that's a proposition that even now the government is accepting. Finally, they've been dragged to the view that climate change is the greatest threat to the reef, but that's something that the scientists have been saying for a long time, and of course, it's something that's being taken into account in this draft recommendation from UNESCO in respect of whether the Great Barrier Reef should be listed as in danger. I think locals are really pragmatic. They want to see the reef survived. It's emotional for them as well, though, because the reef is part of the Far North Queensland identity, but it's also part of the Australian identity. Who are we as a people? We're outdoorsy. We love the beach. We've got this incredible natural wonder on our doorstep. We're proud of it. And that's the case with, of course, so many other natural wonders that we have here in Australia too. And so people love it. People love it far away from Cairns too. If you're in Victoria, if you're in Western Australia, you still love the Great Barrier Reef because it's part of our Australian identity too.
Now, the government is saying that politics was involved in this recommendation. Do you think that's right?
Well, I'm not privy to the same amount of information as the Morrison government, of course, as a shadow minister, and I don't think it's helpful for me to speculate on what might be or might not be behind the decision. I will say that I think Australians would be very disappointed if they thought there was anything behind the decision other than concern for the reef. But what's important here is for people to be able to have confidence in UNESCO in this decision-making process, and so I would really say that the government needs to do everything they can to make sure there is as much transparency as possible in relation to this particular draft recommendation and draft report, and in relation to the forthcoming World Heritage Committee deliberations, where they'll decide whether or not to make these recommendations, whether to actually formalise the draft that's been provided. So the government can make assertions. They have, more, as I say, more of a direct line of sight than I do as a shadow minister, but they need to be insisting on transparency and clarity. And they also need to be standing up for the reef, standing up for Australian tourism, standing up for the Australian environment. And that means doing everything that they can to persuade this committee not to make this recommendation. And part of that, the most important part of that, is pointing to what they are able to do to protect the reef. And I might say on that point, I've been critical about them, of them about this. The Reef 2050 Plan, which is the document that is repeatedly referred to in the draft report from UNESCO, is due for an update. That update was due to be finalised in early 2021, but at the recent Senate estimates, when we asked where the finalised update was, we were told it hadn't even been put before the ministers for sign-off yet. The government actually needs to put a bit more priority on protecting the Great Barrier Reef, and they were warned about this in 2017, I ought to say, by UNESCO, when UNESCO told them to accelerate their efforts in respect of meeting the targets under the Reef 2050 Plan. They need to take serious action to protect the reef, and it has to be a priority because 64,000 jobs, $6.4 billion in revenue, and this iconic natural wonder of the world depend on it.
Well, before the last election, Labor pledged to scrap the more than $400 million grant to the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, describing it as a dodgy backroom deal. Does this remain Labor's policy, and what would it put in place to protect the reef in specific terms?
We have remained very critical of that dodgy backroom deal and the idea that you just give almost $500 million to a tiny, ill-equipped foundation that lacks accountability and say to that foundation, all right, go off and save the reef with this, without a tender, without any clarity. It's something that I find deeply disturbing. It's something that's been criticised by the Audit Office. It's something that has been criticised by a range of people. The Audit Office last month, May 2021, not sure when your listeners will hear this, heard that or gave a report that said that of that almost $500 million, $287 million remains unallocated. So there's still a large proportion of that funding that remains unallocated. Now, we're considering that report, and of course, as we head to the next federal election, we'll be announcing our policies in relation to the environment, including the Great Barrier Reef. But I will say I think it's very concerning for Australians that at the same time as there's been increasingly urgent issues and events in relation to the Great Barrier Reef, the government's signature response to this has been this massive grant behind closed doors that has not outlaid the funding that has been provided to it, still sitting on almost $300 million of it, and also the Audit Office told us has done very little in terms of private sector fundraising. And you'll remember one of the big justifications for this grant was that this foundation was supposedly going to be able to use the money to leverage a massive amount of private sector investment in preserving the reef. That just hasn't happened.
So would a Labor government try to claw back what hasn't been spent?
I think it's really important to say that we obviously are not in government at the moment, so we don't have that line of sight into how useful the outlays that have been made have actually been. Obviously, we have scrutiny mechanisms like estimates, but I don't want to throw any babies out with any bathwater. So I think it is important to say, if there are good, solid investments that have been made that are yielding dividends for reef conservation, then I think we'd all need to be very careful about those. But I do think, regardless of those outlays, two things are really important. Firstly, what's the governance and accountability in respect of existing arrangements? And secondly, what's the future of any unspent money as well?
But you must know how the money has been spent so far and whether that's useful. And also, we're only a fairly short time away from an election, so surely Labor's got to be precise about this.
We will absolutely be announcing our policy as we head into the next federal election. But as I said, it's important to be very careful to say that we will take a sober and sensible look with the benefit of the resources and capacity of government at the things that are already being done. And if they are yielding results, then it's important to consider those. I'll also say that, yes, we can get some program level understandings of what money has been allocated and where, but some of the subcontracted, if you like, programs can be quite small, can be quite granular. And so, as I said, from a position of opposition, I want to make sure that that funding goes towards protecting and preserving the reef. I want to be sure that there are good governance arrangements put in place, that the public, that the people of Australia are getting value for money out of that particular lump of funding. And I also want to make sure that if there are some good things being done with it, that we are taking a good close look at those things too. But I completely appreciate what you're saying in respect of the need to be precise. We don't know when the election's going to be. We don't know if it's going to be in October or whether it's going to be in May. I think there's probably only one person in the country who's got a good idea.
But it doesn't matter in this context, does it?
But what matters is making sure that when we announce our policies, we give a clear picture to the Australian people of how Labor would act in respect of the Great Barrier Reef. And I can say very clearly, the Great Barrier Reef will have a very high priority under an Albanese Labor government. It was Labor that had worked so hard to put the framework in place to prevent drilling on the reef many, many years ago now. We've got a strong history of protecting and preserving the Great Barrier Reef. Conservation is incredibly important, and at the same time, I think all of the science is pretty clear on this. We need a government that will be part of an international effort on climate change, that will be part of a domestic effort on climate change. An Albanese government will absolutely be serious and take strong action on climate change. And when climate change is the greatest threat to the Great Barrier Reef, that's of vast importance to preservation as well.
Well, just finally, on this climate change question, Labor at this point doesn't even have a 2030 emissions reduction target. And Anthony Albanese recently assured the mining industry that the opposition supported the continuing export of fossil fuels. So how can Labor persuasively say it is serious about preventing climate damage and saving the reef?
Well, we can seriously say it because emissions went down under a Labor government and emissions have gone up under a Liberal National government. We can seriously say it because Labor has always been committed to serious international action to bring the world with us on climate change and to work with the world on climate change. And this government has not had that commitment. Climate change is, of course, a global issue, but we need to pull our weight at home. And we will also do it because of our Labor values. And because we see the world's climate crisis as Australia's jobs opportunity, you know that we'll be committed to real action on climate change because we have been talking about nothing more than the renewables opportunities for jobs and the jobs available in associated industries and sectors in responding to climate change. If you have a look at our policy announcements to date, they've been very focused on the jobs opportunities arising from climate change, things like rewiring the nation, things like community battery program, electric vehicles policy. We are a party that is serious about taking real action on climate change and about exploiting, not ignoring, the jobs opportunities that come
but
with it.
But you're still fighting about it internally or debating it internally.
We're really unified on it internally. If you have a look at our announcements, at our policies, at Anthony's budget speech, I assume you're referring to something from one of our members, but if you have a look at...
Quite a loud voice.
Well, if you have a look at what we do, if you have a look at the multiple contributions from across our shadow cabinet and from across our entire caucus, you will see that Labor is the party that will take real action on climate change. We are, in fact, the only party in this country that has both the will to take real action on climate change and the capacity to form government to do it.
Terry Butler, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from this podcast, from The Conversation. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.